Counting in the U.S. midterm elections is underway across America, and many races have already been decided. Both Democrats and Republicans are now bracing for the final results. Also,
we are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator.
A dire warning from the United Nations Secretary General at the UN's climate conference in Egypt. What do Africans want from COP27? Will the world's biggest polluters actually pay up for climate losses and damage? Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome. Great to be with you. I'm Heidi Adams. It is the day after the United States midterm elections, and Washington is on edge as vote counting continues across the country. The final results of these elections will determine which party, Republicans or Democrats, will control the U.S. Congress. We are already seeing signs of a power shift. To help us understand what to expect and give us a look back at the voting process, I'm joined by Steve Reddish. He's an executive producer in VOA Central News Service. And from New York, I am joined by David Monder. He's a professor of political science at City University of New York. Steve and David, a warm welcome to the show. Steve, I'm going to start out with you. It's the day after, the morning after here. And there is a lot that we don't know yet. I mean, results are changing all the time. The numbers are going up and down. But from what we do know so far, what are the big trends and takeaways for you at this point?
The biggest trend so far is that we were expecting a big red wave, a Republican wave election, because President Biden's numbers, approval numbers, were down. Usually the party out of power gains seats in the Congress in a midterm election. This did not happen last night. It was much more of a red trickle. It does look like the Republicans will take the House of Representatives, but by a margin of probably less than 10 points, not the 20, 30, 40 seat margin that we were expecting going in. The U.S. Senate right now is still split down the middle. There are about four races that are still too close to call. Democrats only need to win two of those races to be able to hold on to the House. And three of those races involve Democrats who already own the seats. So it's still a close race. It wasn't the kind of Republican wave that was expected. And the candidates that were backed by former President Donald Trump did not fare as well as perhaps he would have hoped.
Well, we'll get to some more, get into that a little more later. David Monder, what have been the biggest surprises for you? What stands out for you? Are we seeing a total repudiation of Joe Biden and the Democratic Party, or as Steve mentioned, not quite?
I think not quite. The Democrats are actually hearing a much worse performance during these midterms. Of course, I must caution that it's still early days. We still have a lot of key races that haven't been called, particularly in the West. When you think about states like Arizona, states like Nevada, whose vote counting process historically has taken time. And we obviously would expect election challenges from states like Arizona because of the election deniers on the Republican side. So what's really surprised me also, though, is the number of firsts that we've had during these midterms. Massachusetts elected its first lesbian governor in its history. I think that's the first. Maryland has elected its first black governor in its history. Arkansas has elected its first female governor in its history, Sarah Huckabee. Here in the state of New York, Kathy Hochul has become the first female governor of New York. And also Katie Britt has also won a Senate seat. So there's also a number of firsts. even within the broader context of this very fierce fight between the Democrats and Republicans.
Steve, you talked about the Republicans possibly taking the House of Representatives. The margins, we don't know the margin of victory here, but control would be control, right? Whether it's by one seat or by 10.
Correct.
What exactly do you see the Republicans doing with the kind of oversight that they might very well be having in future?
If the Republicans can be a consolidated party, they will likely obstruct a lot of what President Biden wants to do in his final 2 years in office. They will hold hearings and investigate a lot of what is going on in his administration. No doubt if an indictment comes down against the former president, investigations into the Justice Department will take place. There will be investigations of the president's son, Hunter Biden, no doubt, if the Republicans take the House. There will also be likely a lot of negotiations and a lot of legislations that send money out to nations. Foreign aid by the United States will likely be held hostage, will likely be part of a negotiation that the Republican House will start that will cut back and will also put a lot of different requirements and conditions on sending money, especially to countries overseas.
David Monda, I want to tackle that with you a little later on, too. But we have been doing here at The Voice of America a lot of reporting to television stations across Africa. There seems to be a lot of interest. What is of most interest to audiences outside of the United States and other countries, particularly those in Africa? What are people generally looking to find out or to discover about American democracy in this cycle?
I think they're looking to discover the processes of, you know, how democracy works. We remember in 2020, America dropped the ball. We saw forces of autocracy, we saw forces of violence try to take over a peaceful transition of power. So I think this time, a lot of our African viewers are really keenly watching to see how this process will actually play itself out. But I think more importantly, a lot of audiences on the continent are really interested to think about how this midterm election is going to affect the election of 2024. And how that's going to affect the presidential election, because that has a lot to do with the decisions of foreign aid, with the decisions of intervention on the continent, with the decisions of America's commitment, for example, to COP27 on environmental change and climate change. But lastly, I think a lot of Africans are also very interested just in the sheer volume and size of how the elections are conducted and how that will translate in places in West Africa, for example, where we've been seeing democratic backsliding, where military governments have been taking over. So I think it's a whole package for an African view, and I think it's very exciting at this point.
Yeah, one thing that I always find very interesting is that we're having conversations in the United States these days that those of us from the African continent are used to having on the African continent around political violence around election time and intimidation at the polls. There were fears and much apprehension about that possibility. Looking back, did you see any signs that that was a reality at some of the polling stations in this country?
Not in a kind of widespread or major way. There were some irregularities, some vote counting machines, not the actual voting machines, but where you can take your piece of paper and slide it in, those to be counted. Those machines in Arizona, about 25% of the polling places experienced problems with those vote tabulators. It didn't mean votes weren't being counted. It meant that the machine at the time you would slide your paper in, and your vote in, it wasn't working. Those votes were then taken and counted in a separate way. All of that said, it really was, seems to be a very clean, very no violence. Didn't seem like there was a lot of intimidation, at least reports of intimidation at the polls. One of the things, though, that that security experts here in the United States are concerned about are the next 60 days and how, as some states continue to vote to count the votes, whether or not there will be any kind of violence or any kind of issues in that in those 60 days as we move past Election Day and get the final vote counts.
Steve, very briefly, and before I go to David Monda to close us off here, there was a lot of talk about Donald Trump, the former president, was making an announcement about about whether he will run again. Did Donald Trump help or hurt the Republicans this time around?
It didn't seem to help much. Some of his candidates did cross the finish line and did win their elections. Some, right now, it's still up in the air. His selection for Arizona governor is still up in the air. Some other races are still. One thing that is going around Washington is an anonymous quote from an insider in the Republican Party who said the Republican Party now has a Donald Trump problem.
David Monda, Prof, here before we close, we don't have a lot of time, but African leaders will be coming here to Washington in a few weeks' time. Did Joe Biden do himself some favors this time around? Did he help or hurt Democrats? And what will he be saying to African leaders, or should he be saying to African leaders in December that he knows he can actually back up with financing?
I think it's a challenging situation. For Joe Biden, the economy was essentially on the table. It's really a referendum about Joe Biden. So even though the Democrats have not lost as much as they expected, but Joe Biden still has, you know, a tentative hand to do quite a bit. I guess in closing, Heidi, what he'd say to African leaders is, I'm going to try and make some programs within the next two years, but a lot of that will depend on Republican support. And then lastly, there's also a lot of uncertainty about who exactly will run both on the Republican and Democratic side. We know DeSantis won the governorship in Florida. He got a lot of candidates on that side. So might he be the ticket holder for the Republicans? And it's also not sure whether Joe Biden will run for a second four-year term. So that also raises a lot of uncertainty, even for African leaders who will be meeting him, whether he will run, and if he runs, whether he will win against a candidate from the Republican side. So there's a lot of issues still in flux, and it's going to be interesting to see, once all the votes are brought together, what the next 2 years will look like in Washington.
So much at stake, so much hangs in the balance, and never a dull moment. Steve and David, thank you so much for that great analysis. And as always, thank you so much for your time. Well, as Americans voted in the midterm elections, Zambians were keenly following the elections with a focus on the geopolitical implications and how the outcome of these midterms will shape foreign policy, especially towards their country, Zambia. Daniel Tonga brings us more in this report from Lusaka.
The upcoming midterm elections in the U.S. are telling of how America still exerts influence beyond its borders. Zambians are calling for voters in the U.S. to elect leaders who will improve U.S. foreign policy towards Zambia. Relations between America and Zambia under former president of Zambia, Edgar Lungu, were bumpy on many fronts, including human rights. Hopes are rising in Zambia that the midterm election will usher in leaders who will redefine relations.
We are just hoping as Zambia that, you know, whatsoever the results of the elections, the midterm elections in America, we should be able to have leaders who will be able to not bring the division and the conflict that we saw when they were proposing to establish a base in Zambia. So Zambia is looking forward to the leadership that will respect the sovereignty of this country and the leadership that will be able to engage Zambia and not impose policies that definitely are, you know, are rejected by the, you know, sovereign, you know, citizens of this country.
But to some people, the midterm elections will not signal any change in foreign direction, as core principles of human rights, good governance and democracy hardly change in the U.S.
We do not see a Republican midterm Congress outcome in the event that it does come to that, that would all of a sudden prevail over the Biden administration to drop the issues of promotion, observers, as well as protection of human rights. We don't see that happening too much. So there are certain core foreign policy principles that hardly change, depending on which party is in office, and we don't see issues of democracy, good governance, and human rights changing at all.
The midterm elections have also become a reminder that Zambia still depends on the U.S. for aid, and more support for Zambia will still be needed.
We want them to continue with the support, especially on us here in Africa, because we are not a monopoly, you know, as a country ourselves, first of all. And we want to tell you that Africa depends on other people, and the U.S. is one of them. We have been in a very good friendship with them, and we want them to go in there and build up, in fact, increase more funding.
America's democracy remains a best model to follow, and concerns over how Democrats and Republicans will shape economic and political issues in the House will be closely followed by Zambians.
We are living in a global village. What is favoring Americans should also favor Africans here. So, which is not happening, we pray that they will elect leaders in parliament that have a focus on Africans, those that will relate very well with Africans, not segregating. This one is not following our policies, not siding with us. Then you put them in the corner because they have spoken against the elite Democrats.
The outcome of the midterm election will have a major impact on the remaining years of Joe Biden. But for Zambians, the primary concerns still remain closer to home: the need to redefine U.S. foreign policy and more aid to Africa. Daniel Tonga, VOA News, Lusaka.
Well, after the break, we turn our focus to the world's largest climate summit, COP27, this year. It is in Egypt. The UN is warning of, quote, climate hell, and some parts of Africa are already feeling it. We'll look at what is at stake, all of that when we come back.
Excellencies, this UN climate conference is a reminder that the answer is in our hands. And the clock is ticking. We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible.
Well, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, they're warning the world that, quote, we are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator. And this year, the UN's major climate conference, or COP27, in Egypt, has been dubbed the Africa COP. So how much of the summit will be about Africa, or ought to be about Africa? That's a key question at COP27. Another question is whether rich nations, many of whom are the world's biggest polluters, will pay for the climate-related losses and damage that are being felt in less industrialized countries, especially those in Africa. And joining me now to discuss this is Suleiman Babamanu. He is from RMI, a nonprofit that helps countries and communities decarbonize and speed up their transition to clean energy. Suleiman, thank you so much. I know you are RMI's Nigeria Program Director, so it's fascinating and so great to hear from you today. You are at COP27 and you are joining us via Skype from Sharm el-Sheikh there. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Look, I want to get right into it. The summit opened just a few days ago. It ends next week. What's the main theme this year, Suleiman? And what's been the greatest expectation around what people want to see happen this time around?
Thank you very much for having me. So very, very straightforward. The theme for COP27 in Egypt is Together Towards Implementation. And as it implies, what it essentially means is that none of the work that requires to be done to achieve net zero and address the climate, you know, catastrophe that we're dealing with can be done by just one person or a single organization or a single company or a nation. And that is why I think, you know, because going back to what the UN Secretary General mentioned, we do not have the time. It's only 8 years between now and 2030. And that's why for us at RMI, we believe that the conceptual stage for energy transition is actually over. And we need to sort of all agree that time is running against us. And we need a radical implementation kind of approach to achieve those targets. So that is the expectation. And that is what we want to, that is what we are gearing towards.
Now, there are some big asks and expectations of wealthier nations, the world's most industrialized nations, to make right, do right by the rest of the world. What is actually drawing wealthy nations to these kinds of summits? I mean, what's the incentive for them? And then what's drawing less wealthy nations, especially those in African countries?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think fundamentally we need to be able to have a realignment between global finance and development. Energy, climate, and development must go hand in hand. This means that we have to strike a balance between historical responsibilities of wealthy nations that have made the most contribution to this crisis and the development needs for the less wealthy nations. So as we're seeing wealthy nations, you know, who have the historical responsibility, we have seen them make commitments to assist poorer countries in providing financial support towards their energy transition. We're also seeing, on the other hand, less wealthy nations taking steps towards, you know, launching their own energy transition plans. So we can see, for example, Nigeria back in August launched its energy transition plan. And yesterday, we also witnessed Ghana, the president of Ghana was here to launch the Ghanaian sort of their energy transition plan. So there is supposed to be that kind of striking that balance. And right now, what African countries are demanding is action, you know, beyond the commitments, beyond the promises and beyond sort of the pledges that have been done to be able to achieve net zero and the energy transition pathways.
Yeah, because there is that chasm between making commitments and then actually making good on those commitments and then actually implementing what's being asked and decided here. How realistic are the hopes that wealthy nations, who are the biggest polluters, will actually pay for the loss and damage that their industrialization has caused in and brought us to the point where we are in this climate crisis? I mean, a lot of countries are facing economic problems on the domestic front. So where does this then fall in terms of their priorities about where they will spend their money?
Yeah, I think what is very encouraging is to see that finally an agenda item on this matter has been included in you know, building up from COP26 in Glasgow. So this is the first time, you know, we're seeing loss and damage funding being part of the conversation and official negotiations. And even before, you know, COP27, we've seen countries like Denmark taking the lead and becoming the first government to kind of propose funding that is devoted to loss and damage with about $13 million commitment. And we have also seen pledges from other countries like Scotland and Wallonia of Belgium. Now, this is definitely a step in the right direction because, again, like I said, this has to go hand in hand with the conversation that we're having with energy access, with energy transition.
Suleiman, there's this talk about reparations. I know that's what a lot of Africa's young climate activists want from the wealthy nations. And at the same time, there is this talk around helping finance countries to get them to, you know, especially lower income countries, to help make the transition to clean energy. What's the greater priority here? Or can both be accomplished at the same time?
Yeah, I think if you would ask me, I would say it's not one or the other, but both, right? If you look at the millions that, you know, of losses and damage funding kind of rich nations are starting to put right now on the table and contrast it with the billions needed to sort of address the cost of floods in poorer nations. I come from Nigeria, and in the Niger Delta of Nigeria today, that you can, you know, we're experiencing the catastrophic kind of effects of climate change and flooding. It's the same in Pakistan, it's the same in St. Lucia. And, you know, so there needs to be also a balance there. So that perpetration needs to take place in parallel with the amount of investment that is required for, you know, poorer nations to transition out of fossil fuels, for example, towards a just and equitable energy transition.
Suleiman, very briefly, are African nations speaking with one voice as a regional bloc at these summits? I mean, African countries have different interests. They suffer from different types of consequences from the climate crisis. But are we speaking as one voice at summits like these?
Yeah, to a certain extent, you can say that, in the sense that when you look at the statistics, right, there's 600 million Africans that lack access to electricity, close to another 1 billion people that lack access to clean cooking. And if you look at the current kind of annual climate finance flows into Africa, which is barely about 30 to 40 billion, developed countries need to keep their promise, right, of providing that finance. So this particular COP is so essential that in COP27 that we're shifting away from, you know, unfulfilled pledges to radical implementation. And that is kind of the African narrative, you know, one that highlights both the benefits of energy transition as well as putting the people first in terms of energy access and development.
Are you hopeful that Africans will leave this summit feeling optimistic, feeling that, you know, they have been heard and that promises will be kept, very briefly?
I am quite hopeful, but it takes a lot of, you know, commitment and collaboration that needs to happen for, you know, to be able to address these issues. But I'm quite hopeful because this is the COP for Africa.
Okay, Suleiman, I will remain hopeful with you. Suleiman Babamanu from RMI. Thank you so much for speaking to us from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that is where we will leave it for this week. You can find more of our coverage on our website, voaafrica.com. Thank you for being with us on television, radio, and for streaming with us online. We will see you next time. Take care. Goodbye.